Welcome, future medical professionals, to the deep dive. Just take a second. Think about the sheer variety of life out there. It's kind of mind-blowing, right?
It really is. You've got everything from, you know, a bacteria you can't even see deep in the ground.
Right, all the way up to, like, massive blue whales swimming in the ocean. It's this huge, sprawling tapestry. How do we even start to make sense of all that? Especially if you're aiming for science, for medicine.
Well, that's the fundamental challenge, isn't it? We naturally want to sort things, put them in boxes, but with millions of species, it becomes a real scientific necessity. You need a system, a grand catalog, if you will.
And that is exactly what this deep dive is all about. We've actually tailored this one specifically for you, especially if you're, say, a 15-year-old listener thinking about medical programs.
Mm.
We're diving into a core part of Biology Chapter 3 from your textbook, all about biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. And understanding how life is classified. It's not just for ecologists. It's foundational for medicine, too. It's like learning the basic grammar of life before you specialize in the human dialect.
Exactly. It gives you the context for, well, pretty much everything from how drugs work to how diseases spread. So, our mission today, explore the systems biologists use to categorize everything.
Yep.
Bacteria, mammals, the works.
We'll break down those complex science terms, make them clearer.
Yeah, and we'll use some gaming ideas too, analogies to help make it stick. Hopefully give you a bit of a shortcut to feeling really informed for that pre-med path.
And we're basing all this on a solid biology text, so the information is accurate, deep enough for serious study.
So, ready to unpack this grand catalog?
Absolutely. Let's build that foundation.
Okay, first up, the grand catalog of life, classification systems.
Mm.
So, at its heart, what is classification? The book gives a simple definition. The grouping together of things on the basis of features they have in common. Sounds easy enough, right?
It sounds simple, but the implications are huge.
Yeah.
Think about a game you play. Maybe one with a massive inventory or loads of characters.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like an RPG or something.
Right. You wouldn't just dump everything in one big mess, would you? You sort things. Maybe you group characters by class, melee, ranged, healer, whatever.
Or items by rarity or what they do. Potions here, weapons there.
Exactly. You do it to find stuff quickly, to understand what it's good for, how to use it best. That basic idea, that's classification. You're organizing for efficiency and understanding.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
And in biology, it's not just about being tidy. It helps us see the connections, right? The relationships between different living things.
Precisely. And crucially, their evolutionary history. It's like tracing the branches of a huge family tree of life instead of just looking at the individual leaves. And for medicine, understanding those family relationships is key to understanding how biological systems work, how diseases might affect related species, even how drugs might interact.
Okay, so this leads to a big distinction the book makes. Artificial versus natural classification. Two different ways to sort that biological inventory.
Exactly. Two different approaches, each with its own pros and cons, like using different filters in your game.
Let's start with artificial. The book says this is grouping for purposes of convenience, based on one or easily observed features, things you can see right away.
Yeah, like grouping animals just by where they live, show me all the desert creatures, or how they move, list everything that flies, or even just size or color. It's practical, quick. Well, it's superficial.
So in game terms, that's like hitting a quick filter in the character screen. Show me all the sword users or show me everyone who can fly.
Perfect analogy. It's useful right now if you need a flyer for a specific mission, but it tells you nothing deeper, right? Nothing about their backstory, their faction, their skills beyond flying. It's just a convenience filter.
Gotcha. Useful, but doesn't tell the whole story. So natural classification must be the deeper dive.
That's exactly it. This is where biology gets really insightful. Natural classification tries to group organisms according to their natural relationship. It goes way beyond one obvious feature.
How does it do that?
It uses many features, internal as well as external. It pulls info from anatomy, physiology, genetics, biochemistry. Lots of different branches of biology. And here's the key phrase. It aims to reflect phylogenetic relationships.
Phylogenetic. That sounds important. Means evolutionary history, right? Ancestry.
Spot on. Evolutionary ancestry. It's about grouping things based on who they evolved from, their shared heritage.
So going back to the game analogy, this isn't the quick filter. This is like digging into the game's lore. Or finding that hidden family tree for the characters.
Exactly. You might find out that, say, this heavily armored warrior character and this seemingly unrelated magic user actually come from the same ancient lineage or faction. Their abilities look different now, but their origin story connects them.
Ah, so natural classification is about the why behind the similarities, not just the what you see on the surface, why they're related deep down.
Precisely. And understanding that why those evolutionary connections is vital. In medicine, it helps us trace how certain traits or even susceptibility to certain diseases might run in evolutionary families, sometimes across different species.
Okay, so once biologists figure out these natural relationships, how do they actually organize it all? That leads us to the taxonomic hierarchy, right? These nested categories.
Yeah. The book calls the groups taxa, that's plural. One group is a taxon. And these taxas are arranged in a hierarchy, a series of groups. Everything in a particular taxon shares some basic features indicating that they have a common ancestry.
Like Russian nesting dolls, but for life. Getting more specific as you go down.
That's a great way to put it. There are seven main levels, seven main taxa you really need to know. Going from the biggest, most general group down to the most specific. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species.
Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. So kingdom is the top level.
Right. Kingdom is the largest taxon. It contains tons of organisms, but because it's so broad, they share the fewest features in common. Think of it like a huge faction in an RPG, like the Alliance versus the Horde. Massive groups, fundamentally different, but huge variety within each one.
Okay, makes sense. And the other end, species.
Species is the smallest, most exclusive group, the fewest organisms. And the absolute key definition here is that organisms within one species are so similar that they can interbreed and produce fertile offspring in the wild.
Fertile offspring, that's crucial.
It is. So if kingdom is the alliance faction, species is like a specific unit type, maybe a human paladin. Human paladins can breed with other human paladins, make more paladins, but they can't successfully interbreed with, say, a dwarf warrior, different species.
Right. That concept of interbreeding seems fundamental for genetics and stuff later on in medicine, too.
Absolutely. Population genetics, epidemiology, yeah. It all ties back.
And the whole field of study dedicated to this, figuring out the rules, the practice of classification, that's taxonomy.
That's taxonomy, the science of naming and classifying life.
Which brings us neatly to how we actually name things. The binomial system of nomenclature. Sounds fancy, but it's actually pretty elegant, isn't it?
It really is. Devised by Carl Linnaeus, a Swedish naturalist, way back. The beauty is its simplicity. Every organism gets a unique two-word scientific name. Binomial means two names.
Like a universal ID code for every player in the game of life. Something scientists everywhere recognize.
Exactly. The first word is the generic name. That's the genus. And it always starts with a capital letter.
Okay, genus, capital letter.
The second word is the specific name. That's the species identifier. And it always starts with a lowercase letter.
Species, lowercase. Got it.
And there's a formatting rule you'll always see. In print, like in your textbook, the whole two-part name is in italics. If you're writing it by hand, you underline it. That formatting instantly tells you it's a formal scientific name.
So our own species is the classic example, right? Mm-hmm. Homo sapiens.
Perfect example. Homo is the genus, connects us to other ancient human relatives. Sapiens is the specific name, meaning wise, referring to modern humans.
Homo sapiens. Italics. Makes sense. Avoids confusion across languages.
Totally. Whether you're in Tokyo or Toronto, Homo sapiens means the same thing. Just like a unique player ID in a global online game ensures everyone knows exactly which character you mean. That precision is critical in science, and especially in medicine when you're talking about a specific bacteria or virus.
Okay, system understood. Now let's apply it to the big picture. The five kingdom classification. This is like the main map biologists have used for a long time, yeah.
It's a foundational map, exactly. The five kingdoms laid out in the source are prokaryote, protistae, plantae, fungi, and animals, or animalia. Each one has its own set of defining characteristics.
Let's quickly run through those key features. Prokaryote first.
Prokaryote. Key things are no nucleus and no double-membraned organelles inside their cells. This kingdom includes all bacteria. They're the simplest, most ancient cell types.
Okay, no nucleus. Then protistae.
Protistae. These are eukaryotic. That means they do have a well-defined nucleus and double-membrane organelles. The book says they're mainly single-celled or organisms with a cellular level of organization. Think protozoa, algae, a real mix.
Eukaryotic, mostly single-celled. Got it. Next, plantae.
plantae. Multicellular, eukaryotic, and photosynthetic. They make their own food using sunlight. And a big one. Their cell walls contain cellulose. Mosses, ferns, trees, flowers, all the plants.
Photosynthetic cellulose walls.
Okay.
Fungi. These are always interesting.
Fungi are fascinating. Multicellular, eukaryotic, but key difference from plants, their cell wall, not of cellulose, and they are non-photosynthetic. They get food by absorptive methods, breaking stuff down externally and soaking up the nutrients. Yeast, molds, mushrooms.
Absorptive nutrition, non-cellulose wall.
Right.
And finally, animals.
Animalia.
Animalia. Multicellular, eukaryotic, and heterotrophic, meaning they eat other organisms. Plus, a defining feature is having a nervous system. Worms, insects, fish, birds, mammals. Heterotrophic. Nervous system. Okay, the five kingdoms. But wait, what about viruses? They always seem to be the odd ones out.
Good question. The text is clear. Viruses are generally considered to be non-living.
Non-living. Why? They definitely reproduce, cause trouble.
Right. But they can only reproduce inside the cell of a living organism. They hijack the host's machinery. They aren't self-regulating. They can't perform metabolism on their own. They lack the basic machinery of life.
Ah, okay. They need a host cell to do anything.
Exactly. So because they're considered non-living, viruses are not put into a kingdom or classified in the same way that organisms are.
So they're not on the main roster. The gaming analogy helps here.
Yeah.
Like malware, corrupting code.
It's a great way to think about it. They're like malware that needs the game engine, the host cell, to replicate and spread. They aren't a standard player character or environment piece. They're a parasitic threat operating by exploiting existing systems. And for medicine, understanding that distinction viral versus bacterial versus fungal is absolutely fundamental.
That really clarifies it.
Mm-mm.
Okay, we've got the overview, the big map. Now let's actually dive into these kingdoms, starting simple and working our way up.
Sounds good. Let's start with the kingdom prokaryota, the foundation blocks.
Right, the ones with no nucleus and no double membraned organelles, the bacteria.
Exactly. And if you look at a typical bacterial cell structure, the book points out some universal features underlined for emphasis. Always a cell wall, a cell membrane, the internal cytoplasm, ribosomes for making proteins, and their DNA, which just floats in the cytoplasm. Many also have things like a flagellum for swimming or pileal for sticking to surfaces.
So the core machinery is there, but it's not organized into compartments like in more complex cells?
Precisely. That difference, the lack of a nucleus and those internal membrane-bound compartments, is the fundamental distinction between prokaryotes and eukaryotes, which includes everything in the other four kingdoms. And understanding bacteria is vital in medicine. Think gut microbiome, but also infections.
Yeah. Absolutely critical. The gaming analogy here was the basic worker units in an RTS game.
Exactly. Like basic workers. They're efficient, they multiply fast, they do essential jobs in the environment, but they don't have those complex internal factories or specialized buildings, the organelles that the more advanced eukaryotic units have. Simple, direct, often very effective.
Makes sense. Simple but powerful. Okay, from these basic units, we take a huge leap to the kingdom Protoctista, the evolutionary crossroads. These are our first eukaryotes, right? They do have the nucleus and organelles.
Correct. Eukaryotic. And typically mainly single-celled or organisms with a cellular level of organization.
And the book highlights their pivotal position in evolution.
Absolutely pivotal. They arose from prokaryotes, likely through a process called endosymbiosis, where cells merged. And importantly, their descendants evolved into plants, fungi, and animals. They are the crucial link, the branching point in the evolutionary tech tree where life started getting really complex and diverse.
Wow, so they're like the ancestor class that unlocked all the higher tier specializations in the game of life. But the book also calls them awkward organisms, maybe least secure kingdom.
Yeah, it's a bit of a catch-all group sometimes. Because they are so diverse and represent that transition, some organisms don't fit neatly anywhere else, so they land in Protoctista. It's defined more by what they are. Eukaryotic, often single-celled, and their ancestral role rather than a single defining lifestyle like plants or animals.
Okay, a diverse, crucial, maybe slightly messy kingdom. Let's look at an example, the amoeba, classic textbook protectist.
The amoeba is a fantastic case study. Unicellular animal with pseudopods that lives in fresh or salt water. Even though it's just one cell, it's quite complex inside.
Talk me through its parts. Pseudopods.
Right, the pseudopodium. That's not a permanent limb. It's a temporary bulge or extension of the cell used for moving and grabbing food. It forms by the outer gel-like layer, the ectoplasm extending, and the inner fluid part, the endoplasm flowing into it. It's covered by the cell membrane, of course.
And inside?
Inside, you've got the nucleus controlling things, food vacuoles, where it digests captured food, and a really important one, the contractile vacuole.
And the movement itself, that amoeboid movement, it's like flowing.
Exactly. The ectoplasm extends, makes a pseudopod, the endoplasm flows in. It allows the whole cell to ooze along, and it can change direction just by forming a new pseudopod somewhere else. It's incredibly dynamic.
But you mentioned the contractile vacuole is really important. Why?
Okay, think about an amoeba living in fresh water. The water outside has fewer dissolved things in it than the amoeba cytoplasm. So water naturally wants to flow into the cell by osmosis.
Right. Higher water potential outside, so water rushes in.
Constantly. If that just kept happening, the amoeba would swell up and pop, like an overfilled water balloon.
Uh-oh. So how does it survive?
That's where the contractile vacuole comes in. It acts like a tiny bilge pump. It gradually fills with water from the cytoplasm, then moves to the edge of the cell and expels its contents, pumping the excess water out. This lets the cell maintain an almost constant volume. It's essential osmoregulation.
Osmoregulation.
Yeah.
Regulating water balance. That sounds incredibly important for any cell, including human cells.
It's fundamental. Understanding osmosis and how cells manage water is critical in medicine, underpinning everything from IV fluids to kidney function.
And the game analogy for the amoeba. A blob character.
Yeah, like a Gloop in Slime Rancher or maybe a boss from Terraria. The pseudopods are like its shifting hitbox or attack reach, engulfing things with its food vacuole. And the contractile vacuole is its vital internal stability system or pump. It's managing its HP by pumping out water, preventing overload, a crucial survival mechanic.
Amazing what a single cell can do.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on from the protoctists, let's explore the kingdom fungi, the absorptive networkers.
Right. Fungi, we know they're multicellular eukaryotic, but remember they're cell wall, not of cellulose, usually made of chitin, actually the same stuff in insect exoskeletons.
Chitin. Interesting. And they're non-photosynthetic, getting food via absorptive methods.
Exactly. They secrete digestive enzymes outside their bodies onto their food source, maybe dead wood, soil, or even living tissue, and then absorb the broken down nutrients. It's a totally different strategy from plants or animals.
And the book makes a point about distinguishing them from umbilicutes, things like Pythium.
Ah, yes, the water molds. They look and act a bit like fungi, causing plant diseases. But biologically, they're usually classed as protoctists because they do have cellulose cell walls and flagellated spores, spores with tails that swim. It shows how crucial those underlying details are for classification. You can't always judge by appearance.
Details matter. Okay, so what are the main groups, the phyla, within the fungi kingdom?
The source highlights three main ones. First, zygomycota. Think common molds like Mucor and Rhizopus that grow on bread. They're known for forming tough zygospores during sexual reproduction.
Bread mold. Got it. Second.
Escomycota, the sac fungi. This is a huge group. Includes things like Neurospora, used in genetic research, Saccharomyces, that's yeast, vital for baking and brewing, and even Penicillium, the mold that gave us penicillin. They make spores inside a sac-like structure called an ascus.
Wow. Yeast and penicillin. Hugely important group. And the third?
Basidiomycota, the club fungi. This includes the typical mushrooms you see, like the field mushroom agaricus. They get their name from the basidium, a club-shaped cell that produces spores.
So the mushroom cap we see, that's not the whole fungus.
Not at all. That cap, or pileus, is just the fruiting body, the reproductive structure. Underneath, you have the gills, or lamellae, where the basidia are formed, releasing millions, sometimes billions, of spores.
And the main part is hidden.
Exactly. The main body is a vast network of microscopic threads called hyphae. These hyphae might have cross walls, septae hyphae. Altogether, this mass of threads is called the mycelium, and it spreads extensively through the soil, wood, or whatever the fungus is growing on. That's where the absorption happens.
Okay, so the mushroom is just the tip of the iceberg, basically.
Mm.
The real action is underground in the mycelium.
Precisely. Which leads to a good game analogy. Fungi are like a massive underground network or a resource absorption system. The mycelium is the hidden infrastructure, quietly gathering nutrients like a stealthy resource gatherer unit that doesn't fight but just decomposes and absorbs. the mushrooms. They're just the temporary outposts or spore launchers.
That makes so much sense. Understanding fungal structures like that chitin wall is key for antifungal drugs in medicine too, right?
Absolutely critical. Targeting features unique to fungi, like chitin synthesis, is how many antifungal medications work without harming human cells.
Cool. Okay, from the decomposers to the producers, the kingdom plantae, the green producers.
The plants. Defining features, multicellular, eukaryotic, and photosynthetic. They make their own food using sunlight, and their cell walls contain cellulose. They are the foundation of most land-based ecosystems.
And we can see an evolutionary story within plantae, too, moving on to land, starting with mosses.
Right, starting with the phylum Bryophyta mosses, liverworts. In these early land plants, the dominant visible generation is the gainophyte, the part that makes gametes. They lack true leaves, stems, and roots, and, crucially, have no vascular system, no specialized pipes like xylem and phloem to transport water effectively.
So they'd stay small and damp.
Pretty much. They're dependent on water for reproduction, too. Sperm needs water to swim to the egg, as the liverwort life cycle shows. This limits where they can live.
So game analogy. Early game resource generators, like basic turrets, need water nearby, can transport resources far.
Good one. Simple, effective in their niche, but limited by their lack of internal transport.
Then came the ferns. Phylum Thylacinophyta?
Yes. The ferns represent a big step up. Here, the diploid sporophyte, the spore-producing generation, is the large, leafy plant we recognize. The gametophyte is tiny, called a prothallus. The huge innovation. Ferns have true leaves, stems, and roots with an elaborate vascular system of xylem and phloem.
The plumbing, that's the upgrade.
It's a massive upgrade. Allows them to grow much taller, transport water and nutrients efficiently, and live in drier places than mosses. You also see those characteristic coiled young leaves, fiddleheads, and the spores produced in clusters called sori under the leaves.
So ferns are like unlocking stronger structures with better internal logistics. That vascular system is like an efficient delivery network.
Exactly. A key adaptation for conquering land more effectively.
The text also mentions Coniferophyta, the conifers, pines, firs.
Right. They represent another major branch. Key features include cones for reproduction instead of spores or flowers, and often needle-like leaves adapted for conserving water, letting them dominate in colder or drier climates. Think of them as a specialized forest unit or timber resource in the game, suited to specific biomes.
Okay, and then the most dominant group today, angiosperms.
Angiospermophyta, the flowering plants. Yeah, arguably the most successful plant group by far in terms of diversity and distribution.
And their killer app, the big innovation, is the fruit.
Absolutely. After fertilization, the ovary develops into a fruit which encloses one or more seeds. The fruit's job is crucial. It protects the seeds and helps to disperse them efficiently, often by enticing animals. The name angiosperm means container of seed.
Smart design. And they're split into monocots and dicots.
Yep. Two main classes, monocotyledoni, monocots, and dicotyledonia, dicots, based on the structure of their seeds and other features like leaf veins and flower parts.
So angiosperms in the game are like the advanced versatile resource generators. The fruit is like a clever delivery mechanism or seed packet, ensuring they spread everywhere.
Perfect. Their co-evolution with pollinators for flowers and dispersers for fruits has made them incredibly adaptable and widespread. And remember, for medicine, plants are a huge source of drugs. Aspirin, Taxol. Understanding this diversity is vital.
Definitely. Okay, we've covered the bacteria, the protoctists, the fungi, the plants. Time for the kingdom we belong to, the animal kingdom movement and adaptation.
Animalia. The key features again. Multicellular, eukaryotic, and heterotrophic, they eat other things. And universally, they have a nervous system.
And one of the first ways we categorize them is by their basic body plan, their symmetry.
Right. We talk about radial symmetry, like a starfish or a jellyfish, where you can cut it multiple ways through the center and get mirror images. Bilateral symmetry, like us, where there's only one plane that divides you into left and right mirror images. This usually means a distinct head end. And then asymmetry, like sponges with no clear symmetry.
So in the game of life, animals are the active player characters, the mobile units. And symmetry is like their basic body template or movement code.
That's a good way to see it. Bilateral symmetry especially allows for directed movement, hunting, escaping. It leads to developing a head with centralized senses and a brain. Big advantage.
Let's look at some key phyla, starting simple. Cnidaria. Jellyfish, corals, hydra.
Yep, the cnidarians. They have radial symmetry, often two body forms. The polyp, like a sea anemone stuck down, and the medusa, like a jellyfish, free swimming. It's a sac-like body with one opening. And their famous feature, midocytes, those stinging cells.
Ouch. And their nervous system is basic.
Very basic. A nerve net, nerves spread throughout the body, no central brain, like a simple alarm system in a game. Trigger one part, the whole thing reacts, but no complex processing.
Okay. Next phylum, Platyhelminthes, the flatworms.
Flatworms. Now we have bilateral symmetry. They're dorsiventrally flattened, flat top to bottom, also unsegmented. They have simple organ systems, flame cells for excretion, a simple nervous system with ganglia, nerve clusters, at the head end.
And many are parasites, right? Like tapeworms. They have special adaptations for that.
Absolutely. Parasitic flatworms often have hooks and suckers to hang on inside the host, a tough cuticle to resist digestion, and amazing abilities for asexual reproduction to multiply rapidly within the host.
So game-wise, they're like stealthy debuff units, or parasites. Flat shape helps hide, hooks and cuticle for survival inside, reproduction for spreading the debuff.
Excellent analogy. Understanding those adaptations is key in parasitology.
Moving up in complexity, Annelida, the segmented worms. Earthworms, leeches.
Annelids. Also, bilateral symmetry, key feature. A segmented body. Think of an earthworm's rings. They also have a coulom, a proper fluid-filled body cavity. This segmentation allows for more complex movement and specialization.
And they have a better circulatory system.
Yes, a closed circulatory system. Blood stays within vessels, much more efficient transport than just sloshing fluid around. Earthworms breathe through their skin, diffusion over the whole cell surface, which needs to stay moist.
So segmentation is like being modular, each segment potentially doing something different, and the closed circulation is like an optimized delivery network.
Perfect. Allows for larger size and more activity.
Okay, now for the biggest phylum by far, Arthropoda. Insects, spiders, crustaceans.
Arthropods. Huge group. Bilateral symmetry. Defining features. A hard exoskeleton made of chitin. Jointed appendages, legs, antenna that bend. A segmented body, though sometimes fused. And an open circulatory system where blood, hemolymph, washes over the organs.
That exoskeleton is like armor, right?
Yeah.
But they have to shed it to grow, molting.
Exactly. The exoskeleton provides great protection and support, but growth requires molting, shedding the old one and growing a new, larger one. They're vulnerable during that time.
So arthropods are like armored units in a game. The exoskeleton is armor plating, but molting is like having to temporarily drop your shields for an upgrade, leaving you exposed.
A great way to put it. And insects within arthropods are masters of movement. Three pairs of legs for walking, running, often very coordinated, and flight.
Insect flight is amazing.
It really is. Wings are extensions of the skeleton, stiffened by veins. The wing acts as an aerofoil for lift, and the tip moves in a complex figure of eight path to generate both thrust and lift.
Wow, and they breathe differently too. Trachea.
Yes, trachea and spiracles. A network of air tubes, trachea, runs throughout the body, opening to the outside via holes, spiracles. Air goes directly to the tissues. Very efficient and saves water.
Plus metamorphosis, complete and incomplete.
Right, complete metamorphosis. Egg, larva, pupa, adult like a butterfly, or incomplete. Egg, nymph, adult like a grasshopper. Different strategies for development.
So insects are like highly agile aerial units with advanced flight mechanics. The breathing system is like efficient life support, and metamorphosis is like evolving through different forms during the game.
That captures it well. Understanding insect biology is vital for agriculture and controlling disease vectors like mosquitoes.
Okay, finally, the phylum we're in, Chordata. Fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, mammals.
Chordates. The unifying features present at least sometime in their life. A notochord, support rod, a dorsal hollow nerve cord, becomes spinal cord brain, pharyngeal slits, gills, or related structures, and a post-anal tail.
A big story here is moving on to land. Fish use gills, but land chordates needed upgrades.
Major upgrades. Adaptations to land include lungs for breathing air, internal fertilization, so reproduction isn't tied to water, the amniotic egg in reptiles and birds to protect the embryo on land, and fur or feathers for insulation, controlling body temperature, plus limbs for moving on land.
So chordates are like the highly evolved character classes with unlockable skills and gear, lungs, limbs, fur, letting them conquer different biomes. The core chordate features are their base stats.
Exactly, leading to the incredible diversity we see today, from fish to birds to us. Understanding this vertebrate evolution is foundational for human anatomy and physiology.
Phew. Okay, we've toured the kingdoms. Now let's bring it back to today. Biodiversity in action, and what's next? How does this classification stuff connect to the real world?
It connects directly to urgent challenges. Take the example from that article about Arctic hybridization. It's a stark case study.
Right, the one saying Arctic ice melt may promote crossbreeding, further imperiling endangered animals. Melting ice means species that were separate are now meeting and mating?
Exactly. The article mentions at least 22 species are at risk of hybridizing in 34 different combinations. Things like polar bears and grizzlies creating pizzly bears, narwhals and beluga whales, different kinds of seals.
And this isn't creating cool new super species.
Usually the opposite. The article stresses these unions may be far from happy evolutionarily. It could lead to extinction of many endangered Arctic animals because the hybrid offspring are often less hardy. They might be infertile or just not well suited to either parent's niche or the rapidly changing environment.
That's worrying. The lines between species are literally blurring because of environmental change.
It's a direct impact. In game terms, it's like a sudden environmental glitch, forcing incompatible character classes to crossbreed. Instead of getting stronger hybrids, you get debuffed offspring that struggle to survive, destabilizing the whole game world or ecosystem. It shows how fragile these evolved boundaries can be.
So connecting this all back, why does understanding biodiversity, classification, all this detail matter so much for someone going into medicine?
Oh, it's crucial. It's not just memorizing facts. It's appreciating the sheer variety of life solutions, adaptations, evolutionary histories.
How does that help a future doctor?
Think drug discovery. So many medicines come from nature, fungi, plants, even animal venoms. Understanding biodiversity tells us where to look for new compounds, new mechanisms.
Okay, drug sources. What else?
Disease understanding. How do pathogens evolve? How do they jump between different hosts? Understanding the classification biology of parasites, bacteria, viruses, and their hosts, including animal reservoirs, is fundamental to epidemiology and treatment.
Makes sense. Like tracking how a virus mutates or moves through different animal populations.
Exactly. Then there's comparative anatomy and physiology, learning how a fish gill works, how an insect breathes, how a bird's heart is structured. It gives perspective on human systems. Nature has tried countless experiments. We can learn from those diverse solutions.
And the bigger picture, ecological health.
Hugely important. Ecological health. Human health depends on planetary health. A biodiverse planet provides clean air, water, stable climate, potential future medicines. Protecting biodiversity is protecting public health. They're completely intertwined.
Wow. Okay, it really does all connect. Which leads us to that final provocative thought you mentioned. Something to chew on.
Right. As you prepare for medicine, focus mostly on humans, consider this hypothetical. If we found life, say microbial life, on Mars or Europa, how would our current classification system, our taxonomic game rules based entirely on Earth life, even cope?
Whoa, yeah. How would we classify something totally alien? It might not fit into any of our kingdoms. Its basic chemistry could be different.
Precisely. How would we adapt our system? And more profoundly, what could trying to classify truly alien life teach us about the fundamental definition of life itself beyond just our earthly examples?
That's a mind bender. It really pushes you to think about the basic principles.
It reminds us there's always more to discover, more potential diversity out there than we can even imagine right now.
Okay, so let's quickly recap this whole deep dive. We started with what classification is, the difference between artificial and natural systems, and that key hierarchy. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species.
We covered the binomial naming system Homo sapiens and then toured the five kingdoms. Prokaryote, bacteria, protistae, amoeba, algae, plantae, mosses, ferns, flowers, fungi, mushrooms, yeast, and animalia, insects, fish, us, plus why viruses are separate.
We saw amazing adaptations from amoeba movement and osmoregulation to fungal mycelial networks to plant vascular systems and fruits to animal exoskeletons, flight, and transitions to land.
And we connected it to the real world with the Arctic hybridization example, emphasizing why this biological foundation is so crucial for your pre-medical path for understanding drugs, diseases, physiology, and the link between our health and the planet's health.
This really is foundational stuff. So as you go about your day, try looking at the living world through this classification lens. See what you recognize. Maybe look up something that catches your eye.
The more you connect these ideas to real organisms, the more solid your understanding will become. Keep questioning. Keep exploring.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into life's grand catalog. Keep exploring. Keep questioning. And keep learning.